Alrighty. So today we have Tony Jamous, founders of Oyster, joining us. So we are extremely excited to have him today. And so Tony, what I'm really excited about to hear from you is, I mean, maybe first just kind of giving us a quick intro on your background, but really kind of hearing what spurred the idea and especially founding a company in sort of the heart of 2020, and especially when like fintech was on the rise and was this like really hot sector. And did you always know you were going to start a fintech company, or did that sort of factor into the decision as well?
Well, first, hello, Julian, and hello, everybody. Thank you for having me here on the show. And yeah, let's talk about the idea. So so let's take a step back because everything is connected, right? So before starting Oyster, I was the founder of a technology company called Nexmo. Was an API business, a global API business that went public, was acquired, and so on and so forth. And this company have hired people in over 40 countries because we needed to be close to the customer in all these countries. And I was able to witness the power of global hiring. We can not only tap into the global talent pool, but you can also change people's lives, specifically in emerging economies. Myself, originally from Lebanon, had to move to Europe and US eventually to for a better economical future and leave my community behind. And so I was convinced that whatever company I would start next would be a fully distributed company. And in 2019, I was looking at what is the infrastructure available? What are the tools available for companies to adopt a global hiring strategy? And I couldn't find. What I found was an industry called employer of record that are pretty much HR service providers, highly fragmented. There are tons of them in every country that enables you to employ somebody without the need of setting up the local entity, hiring lawyers, accountants, payroll providers. But it wasn't really scalable. You had to pay expensive fees. It took 3 months to set up. And you couldn't really use it for global hiring at scale. And so I knew that if you use software to make global hiring as easy as local hiring, you can not only create a new category, build a successful business quickly, but more importantly, you can change people's life. You can reduce barriers to expanding the opportunity for people around the world. You can reverse brain drain. People like me don't have to leave their home country for a better economical future. And this is where January 2020, I was convinced that my company not only will be a fully distributed company, but its mission is to help other companies tap into the global talent pool. And that's how Oyster started at a very unique time in the future of work history.
Absolutely. So it's obviously fascinating that these learnings from your prior company and this thesis that you had kind of coincided with a global pandemic that kind of thrust everybody else into this way of thinking as well. How did you think about that? Were you just kind of like, this is a great accelerant for us, this is a great catalyst, like great timing? How did you think about that when sort of like March hit and everyone started to go remote?
Yeah, it was a combination of feeling of panic and excitement. Panic because it was like an oh shit moment. We're not ready. We had no software. We haven't hired anybody yet. We just have $4 million in the bank. We raised our seed round. And so we had to really move fast. Like I thought I'm going to, you know, have a period when you start a company to, you know, iterate, make mistakes, you know, have some fun. And, you know, no, we didn't have that. We went right into high growth execution. We had to build a software platform. We had to build an employment infrastructure in 180 countries. And we had to build a team that is today over 600 people distributed in 80 countries and specifically created to be the most diverse team on the planet. We are 110 nationalities. We are 50% women in the business, or at least people who identify as women in the business, and including on the executive team, including on the board. So we're really intentional in building the most diverse and the most employee-centric and mission-driven organization on the planet, and we're seeing what's going to happen, right? So that was an important moment for us. But also, like, that experience made me realize that if you put your efforts in line with your heart, because this, for me, that was why I'm doing this, is primarily a scalable philanthropic effort, right? So for me, it is about impacting people's life positively around the world, people that don't have access to the same opportunity that people have in, let's say, rich cities in the West. When you align what you do with what you believe in, I believe in positive things happening for you in your business, right? So it kind of intensified, you want to call it spiritual belief maybe, but it made me more sensitive to these things.
Absolutely. And I think a few things that you did from the early days that I'd love to dig in on, and one that you just touched upon, which is around, it sounds like the diverse makeup of your team that still exists today, but it sounds like that has to start from the early days. And so what is it around the values or the culture that you created in the early days of the company, and how intentional was that in terms of you, the founding team? Like, how did you kind of set that from day one, day zero, to kind of create the company that you have today?
Every business, especially in high growth environment, need to have a very smart and articulate strategy, right? But we know that culture eats strategy for breakfast. So it was, in our case, culture and strategy are kind of connected, because similar to, say, Salesforce.com, that had to be the best at B2B sales to sell you the best CRM software, or similar to HubSpot, that had to be the best at inbound marketing to sell you the best inbound marketing platform. We need to be the best at employee centricity, remote work, mission alignment, and we sell you a platform that enables you to create opportunities for people around the world, right? So it was very intentional. And how it started is we acquired an acqui-hire in the first few months of our existence, a company called Delocate. Was a consulting firm, a few people that are specialized, because they spent the last 5 years advising companies on remote work best practices. And they came and built for us, and they became part of our team, and they built for us since day one these intentional working practices. How do we work together? The tools and the rules, and how do we branded it Follow the Sun, because we have people in 80 countries, and it's very common on one team. You have people in 10, 12 hours differences. So how do we work together asynchronously in the most effective way? And that became part of our culture. It became the foundation for our culture. And eventually, I hired a chief people officer called Mark Frein, who's been doing high growth startup specifically in remote setting for the last 15 years. So he came and took that work to the next level, and focused really on embedding our mission and what we do into our culture, right? So what does it mean to be the most employee-centric, or thriving to be the most employee-centric? It means three things. It means high level of productivity, high level of engagement, and high level of fulfillment. So we look at this triangle of employee-centricity, and every quarter we expand the surface area of that triangle.
Got it. And how have you held on to that as the company has grown? I think a lot of founders can kind of set these goals, set these values, try to create this culture very early on. But then as the company continues to grow, as they might not be involved in every single hiring decision, that gets kind of harder and harder. And then I think even compounding it with the last few years where companies have kind of ballooned in size, where they just needed to hire a little bit faster, I think that it's gotten a little bit harder to hold on to. And so how have you guys kind of made sure that every hire and the way that you've grown your team has been really thoughtful and core to who you are and your mission?
Yeah. So first, I mean, there are some strategies you can use that we use, which is in terms of adjusting the hiring process to make sure that we hire for fit, for behaviors. We also, but it's not enough, right? I mean, this thing is that people's behavior is a combination of who they are plus the environment they're in. So you can work on changing the environment. And creating. So how do you change the environment? You change the environment by you, the leader of your team or your organization. You need to model the way. You need to be the living example. You need to breathe and live the values and remind people of these values every day. And everything you say and everything you do, people's going to look towards you and learn from you and mimic your behaviors. And I would say last but not least is you need to not make it your own as a founder. It is there. It is, you need to enable the company to define, the team to define these culture and these tools and the way you work together. How do you get things done? How do you react to stress? And then you need to enable them to design that, because you don't want it to be your own. Because many founders, I think they, I don't agree necessarily that the company culture is a founder culture. I mean, there is definitely a massive influence, but if you identified with it, you know, what if the founders need to go, right? Or need to change role, or what happened then, right? So you have to create resilient cultures, and resilient culture are co-created by the people that are forming that culture.
And maybe shifting gears a little bit, but definitely want to continue on this topic of things that you decided, like in the founding days of the company. I think there's two other things that you mentioned that kind of come off a little bit contrarian to me, especially maybe not today, but back then. And one is, I believe the company is kind of headquartered in North Carolina. And so what was the decision in terms of starting your company in a non-major tech hub? And did you at all think about the challenges of fundraising back then, especially when at that time, everything wasn't on Zoom? How did that play into, what was the decision around that? And how did that play into, especially the early fundraising?
Yeah, so actually, our legal address in North Carolina is just a legal address that we have to have a legal address. The reality, Jillian, is that we have no offices. We have no headquarters. We are distributed in 80 countries. We did that, and we raised over $220 million in the first 3 years of our existence, pretty much without meeting the vast majority of our investors. And this is thanks to the change that happened in the world. So it's a very positive change. Like, you don't have to be in the Silicon Valley. You don't have to have Silicon Valley address. Although I did ask my general counsel to change it to Silicon Valley, and she said no. I don't want to go against her. Sometimes she scares me. Miranda, I love you so much.
Fair enough.
You know, it's like we could have put, you know, a virtual address in Silicon Valley, but for us, we're not playing necessarily these perception games. We're building a business.
Absolutely, and I think to that second point, I think obviously as COVID progressed, more increasingly people raised without having actually met in person. But it sounds like your first seed round happened prior to March 2020, and so that was before most teams were fully remote, and you kind of really started with this thesis of wanting to have a remote team. And so that was something that, again, was kind of bucking the normal trend. And so how was that perceived by your initial investors or initial investors that you spoke to?
Yeah, actually, prior to really formalizing or formulating the pitch deck or the idea Oyster, I was kind of entertaining this business opportunity with some of my VC friends in Silicon Valley. And the vast majority of the feedback saying, sorry, we cannot invest in a company that is not, you know, 20 miles away from our headquarters here. And I said, fine, you know, I'll go ask my friend Pietro in London. He's a founder of Connect Ventures, to see the company. And this is how we started. And after that, many VCs wanted to talk to us. You know, we were not only we, but the category we represent, global employment platforms, was and still is one of the hottest category in SaaS fintech for the last 3.5 years.
Absolutely. So I'm going to definitely come back to fundraising and growth, just given, as you mentioned, how much you've raised and grown over the last 3 years. But I want to touch upon the sort of early days of Oyster away from funding. And I guess maybe think about your co-founder journey. And so I guess, how did you guys meet and what was that decision in terms of both of the co-founders, but also early employees in terms of how they were the right people to partner with? And was there ever a time super early that maybe you thought they made the wrong decision? And how did you kind of like get through that?
Yeah. So I'll tell you about my co-founder experience right after this. But I want to tell you that today, every one of my executive team member, that's probably much like 15 people right now, are hired through a thorough and extensive executive search process. Why we did that?
Is that using an executive search firm, or I guess how did you conduct that?
Yes, so I've hired Andrew Banks, the first person I've hired in this business, who was my advisor, executive search advisor. He was the founder of True Search in Europe, which is one of the largest executive search firm in technology. So he came and led the search of all of my executive team. We were very thorough in the process. We spent at least 4 months looking for the person. Sometimes it took a year and a half to find the right person. We interview 50% from each gender, regardless of the role. And sometimes it's very difficult. Think about CFO and technology. There's like less than 5% are women. And our CFO is Shannon, and we have a case study, pretty extensive case study that takes an hour of presentation with questions. So we look at multiple options as well, right? So we have a process that minimizes the error that we can make on hiring. Although, you know, there's always going to be mistakes, but it minimizes dramatically.
And so as you're thinking about your executive team, I know you have a global workforce. Is there any consideration in terms of where they're based in terms of time zones or anything like that? Or is it very open?
My executive team is primarily in Europe and US time zones. We don't have anybody in Asia. And the challenge we face is that finding talent with experience in building high growth SaaS companies at scale that don't exist outside of these markets yet, right? So you see us on the top, we are not as diverse as on the bottom when it comes to geographical diversity. We're pretty much Europe, US, because, you know, there's no chief revenue officer who scaled the company to 500 million in 3 years in Africa. There's none, doesn't exist yet. But our hope is that in 10 years, this is the new reality we're going to enter, because we're going to get people exposed to this opportunity. Let me give you this example. I had a Nigerian developer in my previous company. He was working for us in London. He went back to Nigeria and he started a company that is today the Square of Nigeria, right? That is growing really fast. They raise money. And so because he was exposed to venture-backed technology companies, he was able to leverage that opportunity. So we believe that with giving people opportunity to work for these amazing companies, no matter where they are, we're going to democratize access to opportunity. And
got it. I think that's great. And what was it like convincing, especially in the early days, first hires to join? And obviously, as you've grown, kind of convincing some key senior hires to join, it has gotten easier. But also, as you've seen the talent market change over, especially the last year, how have you guys thought about that changing? And how has it impacted your ability to hire? And maybe given you have such insight on your customers, have you seen that that has changed for them as well?
Yeah. So in our case, I had to convince myself to be able to convince others. So when I started the business, I wrote this, 20-page long memo around why this is a massive business opportunity and why I should care about it compared to all the other options I had to do in my life. And that paper got refined by investors, advisors, including my executive search partner, Andrew, and he took that memo and he turned it into a pitch for attracting talent. And essentially what we offer to these talent is the combination, the intersection of high growth technology opportunity with upside and high growth, but also mission impact and fulfillment. So our president, Ellen, for instance, she used to run operation at Facebook. She used to run an organization of 10,000 people, right? She decided to join us, not because she need to, but she want to. She wants to really put her vast experience and knowledge into the service of reducing inequality. So this is being mission-driven makes you a talent magnet. And also being a distributed company and doing it well makes you a talent magnet. Actually, when Airbnb announced that they are moving to fully remote, their job board got 10 times more traffic. We used to receive 13,000 job applications a month, company of less than 2 years old. So moving to distributed work and doing it well make you a talent magnet. I have a feeling that there's another part of your question I don't answer, Jillian.
No, I think that's helpful. And maybe shifting gears a little bit, as you were in the early days, given how big this market is, you were not the only one trying to tackle this. And so what gave you the confidence, maybe before kind of thinking a little bit more about competitive landscape, but like that this could be a market where there'd be multiple big companies versus a one size fits all?
Yeah, the confidence came from the fact that it was very unlikely that this category would have a thing that you would expect in one winner takes all structures. Like it wouldn't have virality in it. It wouldn't have a first mover advantage. It would have high barrier to entry, and you can keep making these barriers higher and higher. But once you're in, right? And so that's kind of where it became evident that this is not a one winner takes all market. And when we look at the rival set, we call them rivals because we're not here to beat them. We're here to learn from them. It's unlikely that we're not seeing anything that really will displace us. You know, like it's not like there's, and it's not like we have the smartest people working on this. You know, it seemed that it is going to be some sort of category with maybe 3-4 players who's going to reach a significant scale, and we were there at the right time to be part of that. Now, because of what happened, an acceleration of remote work and the wave that we've seen that continues, by the way, it continues because now hiring is really about cost effectiveness, so companies are looking for ways to hire people in lower cost countries. It is unlikely that we're going to see more competitors coming in because of the barrier to entry and the funding that happened in the category. And there's over $1 billion of funding that went into funding the three major players in this category. So I would doubt that any other smaller player can enter anymore.
Absolutely. And how, I like that you guys call them rivals rather than competitors. And that kind of goes into my next question in terms of the culture and internal communication of how you guys spoke about the landscape. And especially when you saw, given how much money has gone into the space, like when you see the headlines of how much your competitors or rivals were raising, like how did you kind of manage that, especially if there was, did it bring on any stress and like, I guess, or fuel fire? Like how did you guys kind of manage that internally?
I think first by changing why we're here, you know, we're not here to beat the competition. We're not obsessed with the competition. We're obsessed of building a platform that enables us to achieve our mission. So I would say there's not as much anxiety about the competition in this company than in my previous companies. And actually, it's a good thing, because what can you do about it? What can you do about your competitor raising $300 million? Nothing. Just, you know, like it's you have to stay focused and do your job, go back to work and do your best, improve things every day. So you have to really be, as a leader of your team, being a human-centric leader requires us to make sure that we filter out any unnecessary anxious thoughts that could come and reduce the quality of the experience of your employees, because you want them to be focused, you want them to be fulfilled, you want them to be productive, you want them to be able to go home after work. My home, my work, I work from home, but you know, if you want to go out of this office here, you want them to shut down notifications, right? So what needs to happen for you to enable that environment is not to over obsess with competition, but focus on the customer, focus on the mission, focus on your team, and making sure they have their best environment for them to be successful.
For to your point of, yeah, you working from home and whatnot, you've seen an increasing number of companies that are remote hosting, like whether it's quarterly offsites or something like that. How have you guys created a strong company culture being fully remote and making sure that that kind of resonates throughout everyone? And do you guys do some sort of offsites or something to make sure that people are kind of having that camaraderie?
Yeah, so we have a number of strategies we use internally to create a feeling of belonging into the culture in a virtual way. I can give you some examples. We have an app called Kona we use that measures the sentiment of people are feeling every day on a team basis, so we can interact with how people are feeling. We are really obsessed of creating massive amount of psychological safety so people can show up their true self and not being afraid of making mistakes and saying what they feel. So we also have certain other social activities we do virtually to connect in a less professional setting. That being said, we do feel the need to meet in person from time to time. So I've had two executive offsite for my team in the last 3 years. We're going to do one with my C-suite next week in London. So some teams also can meet on a theme basis. So we had a product offsite with product marketing a couple of months ago to achieve a specific goal. Unfortunately, as a 650 people company distributed in 80 countries, bringing everybody in one location is a huge expense in an environment where every VC on the planet is telling me, extend your runway. So it's unfortunately, interest rate plays a role against a meeting in person for Oyster. And it's sad.
Absolutely. And on maybe on that same front, are there ways when, like, when you've had really big successes and milestones, I guess, how do you celebrate it? Both you personally, but like also as a team, and are there ways that you guys go about doing that to make sure that everyone's kind of feeling the successes together?
Yeah, we don't celebrate it enough, in my opinion, specifically on my C-suite team. People tell me I'm too serious, including my mother. We do have our monthly all hands meeting, and this is an opportunity to celebrate the successes in public. We use a lot Loom recorded videos in the business, so I tend to share a lot of that through Loom. We have a channel around recognition, specifically on Slack, pushing us to really celebrate and recognize people And you have processes around it. So as you know, busy CEO of a 600 people company, growing really fast, I cannot be aware of everything that happened in the business. So I have a process that, think about it as a bot that goes in the company and get me all this information about recognizing people and help me to recognize them, to make sure that we do what we say and say what we do.
That's great. And maybe shifting gears a little bit again to fundraising. You mentioned earlier kind of raising over $200 million all on Zoom. And I'm curious from your perspective, like during a time of such abundance of capital across the industry, but I invest specifically in fintech. Obviously, fintech has been extremely, extremely popular the last few years. What resonated most with you in terms of how did you decide, especially without meeting your investors, what was right or which investors were right for you? What did you optimize for in fundraises? And is there anything that stood out as most notable that made you think like, I have to work with this person or fund, whether or not you actually ended up working with them?
Yeah, so true story, we didn't optimize for valuation, we optimized for the partner. And we did got multiple offers, and although there were different levels in terms of valuation, we opted out in a kind of most cases to a lower valuation because we wanted to work with that person, wanted to work with that partner, wanted a partner that were first and foremost mission aligned and can really bring significant value to the business. So that was really the optimal variable that we had to optimize for, is this connection, this fit with the partner, not even the firm, right? Sometimes it's really the partner that is the key, because this is a person you're going to be working with them very, very closely.
That's great. And is there anything, I'm curious if there was like one instance that stood out to you of like, you had a conversation and it was like, I absolutely have to work at this person. Or is it really just kind of make like the conversations over time? Because obviously, especially the last 2 years, getting to know someone was harder, not necessarily because it was over Zoom, but because oftentimes the fundraisers happened a lot faster and that time was really condensed.
One of our main investors, I wanted to work with him because he was considered to be one of the best SaaS investors, and because he really wanted to invest because of the mission of Oyster. He really wanted to make a bet on a mission-driven company, first and foremost. And he has a lot of wisdom and experience to bring. And another example is one of our investors also that I've decided to work with was a team that decided to come visit me in person where I live in the island of Cyprus, and spend a couple of days with me here to get to know me, and gave me the opportunity to get to know them. And in a world where all term sheets happen over Zoom, that made a difference.
Absolutely. So I would love that trip as well. So at what point in the Oyster journey, and I know it's obviously continuing, but in the early days, did you feel like you had something special and at least early signs that you're like, you know what, this is clicking and this is working?
What's unique about Oyster is that it happened right away. It was working even before we had a product, because we started the company in January 2020. We raised fund in March 2020, and we started building the software and the team back then. So we had demand lining up before even having a product. So that was a unique moment for us, because it was an amazing to be able to have the demand and build a product to supply that demand, other than the other way around, create a product and create the demand for it, right? Which made that we didn't even had a product market fit problem. We were fitting our product to the existing demand. That was a moment where we knew that the decision we're going to make at that time is going to be, we're going to have to make a very quick decision, and we're going to have to make very good decision very quickly, right? Because any small decision you make there, it could be a bigger impact later down the line. So for instance, hiring our chief legal officer, right? Our general counsel, Miranda was employee number 7 in the company. Like any startup, most startups don't hire general counsel until they're like 200 people, right? So here it was critical because it was part of the product, part of the platform, I was lucky to find Miranda, who already had her career. She was an employment lawyer working for the largest professional employer organization in the U.S. So she, and her job was to take employment compliance and integrate it into software. So, and that was employee number 7.
How much do you think that you had the thesis that this was going to work, but that just like how quickly it took off? Timing played a huge factor in kind of that serendipity.
Let me give you some statistics. We started the operation in the second half of 2020. 2021, we grew 11 times to reach double-digit ARR in the first year of operation. That's how fast. So 0 to double-digit of ARR in 12 months.
That's incredibly impressive. Yeah, I mean, you don't see that much. I think like obviously having the conviction in terms of this is where the world is heading, but having the catalyst of the change in the workforce pretty quickly as well, I'm sure helps a little bit in terms of getting you there a little bit faster as well.
That's why I believe that this intersection of doing well and doing good is connected, right? So if you design a business model that is totally and fully aligned with doing well, it is very likely that the star will be aligned for you in terms of your growth and your successful success in general. That's the theory I'm testing with Oyster, right? I mean, so far it's proven correct.
Absolutely. Perfect. So I want to ask you probably just two more questions that are a little bit more fun. What surprised you most about this founder journey?
What is surprising is that it's really, really hard to disconnect from it. It's like you identify with it, you become it. Like it is fun from one side because you're like fully absorbed with this very exciting work that you're doing in your life, but it has a side effect as well because you wanna, how do you create, like if you were a normal employee, you know, you can quit. Right here, if you're a CEO, like you think about quitting every 6 months, but you cannot quit, right? So I think this is where there need to be some sort of practice to create a dissociation between you are not your work.
Absolutely. And maybe a half question because you've led me into this, but how do you deal with the mental stress of kind of the ups and downs of being a founder and the fact that you can't necessarily walk away the same way that an employee can.
A few practices that I've been developing throughout these years, and by the way, it's always 2 steps forward, 1 step backward, these processes, so they're no perfect solution. You have to try and test many things. So really focusing on taking into account my well-being in terms of being able to have my flexible work time. For instance, on Friday, we have our focus Friday. We don't have meetings during that day, so I can really catch up on things, so I can completely disconnect in the weekend and recharge. I'm ready for the next week. Another way actually to deal with it is to be part of a supportive community. So I created Oyster. We have a mental health channel at Oyster where everybody can come and ask for support from the Oyster community. And you can be more vulnerable as a CEO there. Maybe not too much, but sometimes feeling supported by your work colleagues actually can be helpful. There's also other practices such as physical exercise, meditation, to really get out of this mind mode, because it's really, really hard for me to turn off my brain and stop thinking about the company, you know?
Yeah, completely agree. I think figuring out what that routine is and what's best for you and how you can step away is incredibly important. And then truthfully, last question is, if you weren't doing this, building Oyster, what would you be working on?
Honestly, I would be just spending time with my children. I have 3 small children right now. 7 years old, 3 and 2. And I feel that there's not enough time in my life to be there for them. And I feel that my work is in opposition and contradiction with that desire I have as a father to be fully, fully present for them at any point in time. So if I wouldn't be doing that work, I would be more and more dedicating time to them in that critical phase of their life.
Amazing. I love that. Well, Tony, thank you so much for the time today. I really appreciate it and really appreciate you being so honest with us in terms of the journey in building Oyster. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.